Hey, sister girls, it's me, Cherie, also known as the Sister Girl Next Door, and I'm back with another podcast episode. On this episode, I got a chance to talk to author Kim Johnson about her debut novel, This Is My America. Sister girls, when I finished reading this book, I instantly wanted to speak with Kim. In my opinion, this book should be required reading in all schools. Every black child needs to read this book. It's that powerful. This novel is rich and layered. It promotes discussion and will leave you questioning the legal system. You will also question what justice looks like for black and brown people. It definitely goes there. And while the story is heavy, it also showcases black joy, the black family, and even young black love. Every week, 17-year-old Tracy Beaumont writes letters to Innocence X, asking the organization to help her father, an innocent black man on death row. After 7 years, Tracy is running out of time. Her dad has only 267 days left. Then the unthinkable happens. The police arrive in the night, and Tracy's older brother, Jamal, goes from being a bright, promising track star to a thug on the run, accused of killing a white girl. Determined to save her brother, Tracy investigates what really happened between Jamal and Angela down at the pike. But will Tracy and her family survive the uncovering of the skeletons of the Texas town's racist history that still haunts the present? That was the synopsis for This Is My America. Now, sister girls, sit back, relax, and enjoy the interview. Thank you again to Kim Johnson for taking the time out to do the interview. We are in a pandemic, and she said yes, and we had a great conversation. Enjoy.
Once again, I'm so happy to have you. Kim Johnson, you're an activist, college administrator, and a mentor to young people. And you've written the book that I feel like, and I'm not even like being funny, that every black kid needs to read. It was like the book, when I finished reading, I was just like, my niece needs to get it. My cousin needs to get it. Everybody with a kid needs to get it. So what was the thought process behind making Tracy a teenage girl and not a little older, like maybe college age or even like, I don't know, 21, 22 in that lane? She's 17.
Yeah. So sure. I'm so excited to be on. I just love talking to my sister girls, black girls, black women. They're just the funnest to talk to because I don't have to explain so much because you totally get it. But I write young adults. So I've always, in the past 9 years when I started writing, I really chose young adult because I love that coming of age time period. It sort of is a throwback to when I was growing up. I didn't have books like this that could help me think about issues and how I could be involved. And I was always someone who was very involved. And so that voice was never there. I would absolutely actually love to write a college aged or a, that 18 to 22 time period, because I work at universities. I worked at universities for the past 20 years. And so I know that age group so well. But it's such a hard market. And so when I was thinking of this story, I really had only thought of it being a teen. And it being something that I could, when I get my college students, in hopes that maybe they would have actually read my book before they, hit that college age, because so many of the students that I work with and mentor are often, they feel bamboozled, or they feel like they have been not jaded, but they just haven't had that opportunity to learn about a lot of different things or why things are a certain way, or even thinking about how they could be involved for change. And so that's sort of really what connected me to write for this particular age. So
thank you for that. I jumped, like, as soon as I saw you, I'm like, I just need to start asking the questions. But how are you doing? Like, how is everything treating you? How's COVID? Like, how are you dealing with that? And like quarantining and just staying in place and people not staying in place and us wanting to get out. So how are you doing today?
it's hard. It's really, really hard. I'm actually generally a very upbeat person. I'm still upbeat. I always try to look at the best of things, make the best of things, try to be there to support other people who are really struggling. But I think being a debut, being a mom of two, so I have a 6-year-old who is now in first grade, and a 6-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old boy who is starting 8th grade. They're at very different levels of need and care. Married, work full time, advisor, involved in organizations, and I don't want any of those to drop. And I think that probably is the hardest thing being in a debut year, is not wanting to have my writing career drop, and almost feeling like I don't have time to actually stop and realize how, like, how much time I actually need a break. Like, I really, really honestly, I need a break. Anytime we take a vacation from work, I'm actually doing writing stuff, or I'm doing, you know, taking time off our podcast. It's just been hard. And I think in particular with my book, because it deals with, I wrote it to be timeless, but it is so timely also. That's an added weight for when my book came out, around protests around the country, conversations around, you know, mass incarceration and criminal justice, defunding the police, all of these things. It makes me not want to not, like, stop and do some things, because I feel like I'm supposed to I felt like I was supposed to write this story. I felt like I was purposed to it. I felt like ancestors around me were pushing me to tell this story in the way that I did. And for me not to engage in conversations around it, I feel like it's taking away from my purpose. But I also need to just stop and just chill and
watch some Netflix. I feel you, because when you started giving me that list, I was like, girl, I feel you. So how has it been? You said you're writing, I feel like you're always on the go. How has that interrupted your writing? Because some writers are saying that it's been like this burst of creativity, while other writers are just like, no, girl, I'm just trying to figure out how to get these kids on virtual learning, cook, and make sure the house don't burn down at the same time. I have had that burst of energy. So how has it been for you to stay creative while going through literally a pandemic, and then having children, and then, you know, being a mom and a wife, you know, to keep those creative things juices flowing?
Yeah, I haven't, the first probably four, so started quarantine early March, probably the first 4 months, I wasn't able to really touch anything. Like, I couldn't get into my new story. My new story is very different than this story. It's has a male POV, it's historical. It's something I need to be very careful about how I write. So that it was a bit paralyzing to me to try to finish it, although I had like basically the first half of the draft done. But then once my book was about to come out, I was like, man, people who've read it early are like, oh, I can't wait to read your next book. I was like, I guess I better finish it. So that was motivating to me. Yeah. And just hearing from readers who were like, I can't wait to read your next book. I was like, me too. Let me finish writing it. And so I've actually been really on it. So like for the past couple months, I've been writing really regularly, and I have my draft to my editor that's actually due on Tuesday. And so I'm just kind of finalizing some stuff out. And so finally I've gotten it, but it was sort of like a forced thing of like, okay, time's not going. My health routine I said I was going to do, walking regularly, didn't happen. So it's been 7 months. So I guess I'm just going to be like writing.
I feel you, but I'm happy that you're still motivated and you kept going, because I am like, I'm waiting. I'm one of the people and I'm like, girl, yes, I know you got a lot going on, but I want to know what's coming next. So just to get into a little bit about you, you're an activist yourself. So what made you choose storytelling as one of your mediums to get your message across, instead of like teaching or painting or, you know, something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been a lifelong activist, and now I actually sort of see I've turned the corner where maybe that's not the term that really fully encapsulates me. I think I'm an organizer. I think I help amplify other people who do the work, because I connect with a lot of young people. So in the organizations I'm involved in, I'm often a voice of how do we get young people to be engaged and involved and making sure that they feel like they're supported. For it. And, you know, for writing actually was something that was cathartic and therapeutic for me. I had never really written before. I was 32 when, you know, my son was, you know, maybe 2 years old, year old, something like that. And I was busy with work. I was in a new city where my husband was from. I had like no friends. And I didn't have anything for me that I was used to doing for me. And so I actually just started taking all the stories that used to be in my head and writing them down. Mm-hmm. And then as I got used to writing my books, like figuring out how you write a book, how do you actually craft story? How do you, you know, tell something that's really engaging? By the time I wrote This Is My America, I figured out my pattern of who I want to be as a writer. So I am someone who reads a ton of nonfiction. James Baldwin is someone that I frequently go to. I see him as this ongoing person who has witnessed the times and bared witness through many times. And I realized that my love of YA and my love of activism and my love of understanding history, past and present, could all actually be in storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I feel that now as I'm older, and you know, how can I create my own legacy that touches on a larger platform in a way that I can't necessarily do in my current work structure or the current city that I live in, that kind of thing.
That's like dope, because I was just like wondering, like, how did you pick this? And I'm like, it's activism, it's like mystery, it's so many different things, but it's encaged in like this little town, and it's just like so much is going on, but it's like right now, it's like, even though it's a fictional story, this story is real somewhere, like, you know, in that atmosphere it exists. And so when writing, because this story is very emotional, is very heavy, how did you separate yourself at times when it got too heavy, so that you can walk away and be like, well, I'm still, like, you know, I can now go watch TV and I can like eat a meal? Because I know that can be draining to lock in so deep and then come out of it. Like, how are you able to find that balance?
Yeah, I think that I'm slightly different in that actually writing it out is cathartic for me. It is pouring out all of my frustration and pain, especially during the time period that I was writing. There was so much going on in the news that was incredibly frustrating. I was doing a lot of research on innocence cases, interviewing people that I know, obviously, too, who not necessarily were sentenced with a death sentence, but have been incarcerated for things they have done and things that they have not done. And when you're hearing people's story, I think it goes back to just bearing witness, thinking about James Baldwin talked about bearing witness. I just felt like I was doing something really important and I needed to do that. I also work with young people in advising. And so I deal with a lot of crisis cases. So the work that I do, I have a lot of, a large portfolio that deals with about like 15,000 students. And so a lot of the high crisis cases do come to me. And so I'm used to already balancing out, how do you not take on other people's, how do you be empathetic, but how do you not take on that trauma? Mm-hmm. And how do you work through trauma on your own and be able to still go on? And so for me, it's keeping busy. So yeah, that's how I would. So it's cathartic to write it, to put it out. You know, moments, a lot of people talk about like, oh, I cried in this part. I did too. Like, I would be in a public place writing, because that's the only time I can get away from my kids, because I actually have to leave my house, other than now the pandemic, which is probably one of the reasons why I delayed writing. I was like, oh my God, where do I write? They're everywhere. They keep interrupting me. I can't get anything done. Yeah. And then finally I got over it. But like, I think to me, I like visceral stories that are visceral, stories that you can feel and you know, that you can like taste, eat, you know, like you just feel like you're a part of it.
Yes.
And so if I'm not doing that, then it doesn't feel real to me. And so, so part for me, being emotional and crying actually gets it out. It makes me feel better. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's how I sort of like process things through this time period, and not consuming so much, because that's really important. So right now, a lot of people are talking to me about like, oh, are you watching this one show, or did you look into this one case about this innocence case? And I've shared like, right now, actually, I can't do that. I can't watch that, because I have just experienced it so much. I kind of need a break from it, and I'm talking about it so much. That to me is actually overwhelming, because then I do start to feel paralyzed, that like, I need to do something. What can I do? But mm-hmm. then it's like, but I'm a storyteller. Like that's what I do. And so that to me is actually the piece that's harder, is now the aftermath versus the time period when I was writing.
Yeah. And I never thought about that. Like, I would think that the time, once it's over, it's just like, you kind of could breathe out and just like, okay, I release it. But I never thought that it could carry its weight over, especially, yeah, well, obviously the topics. So this tale, sadly, in the Black community is not new. Tracy is literally fighting for her father's life. He's in prison. He has 267 days before, you know, because he's on death row before he gets, in my opinion, murdered. And
mine too.
So before he gets murdered, and she's doing everything in her power, right? So my thing was, even though we've heard about the kid who had a parent, who's a Black kid who has a parent in jail or prison, we've never really largely talked about the kid who has a parent on death row. So why was that important to incorporate that aspect into the story?
Yeah, I read Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy, and the way that he told his life story and the people that he worked with, he has a beautiful way of just expressing the humanity of people's condition, mm-hmm. And experiences, and that they're not the worst thing that they have done. And I was really frustrated by the conversation that was going around 2014 and 2015 when I wrote the book, because so much of the conversation around our criminal justice system was just on police brutality. It was, there's mm-hmm. a video. We visually watched the trauma of someone Black being murdered on our TVs and social media. And then it became just about fighting over the conversation of whether it was right or wrong, or what that person should have done instead, or bringing back all the negative things that that person has ever done, and having to defend their humanity. And I wanted to demonstrate that if someone can actually be wrongfully incarcerated and be killed by the state, so I do consider it murder, that you're murdered by the state, it's state sanctioned. If you could get it wrong, then what else are we getting wrong in our criminal justice system? And I think that that's something that then, it's sort of like this pushing readers to think about probably the hardest thing that you could ever think about experiencing, is that you're on trial for murder, for something that you didn't do. And then you then now are sentenced to prison and you're waiting for that time period. I also wanted to turn the lens not on the cases, because I think that that's often what happens, is that you actually don't get a chance to look at the families and how it impacts the families.
Like, and that words in the text and the story.
Yeah. And
the kid.
Not the heart, not like what it means to not have her father there, what it means for it to potentially impact her brother, and that generational cycle that occurs all too often. And so that's where I really wanted to tell that story. And people ask me about why I then added the thread of Jamal, her older brother, yes, being accused. and one of the reasons why I wanted to do that is I did want to demonstrate how incarceration impacts cycles of family over generations. If you look at data, if you look at research, if a parent is incarcerated, the children are much more likely to either have interactions with social welfare systems, or at some point be incarcerated themselves. And I wanted to show why that bias continues. And it almost is a demonstration of the bias within what happens to the Black community, is that sort of automatic guilt.
And it was
that
just
occurs.
That it was just like he was guilty. Like he had to have been guilty because look at his father. And it was mm-hmm. like, look at him. All of a sudden, it didn't matter. Like, because, you know, as readers read, he is like a track star. He is the golden boy. He's on the news for being great. And then it's like you flip that switch. And it's just like he goes from being like this cool kid to like this grown monster. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In that moment. And he doesn't get any type of like, well, maybe it's not him. Like, maybe he didn't. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not that. So that leads me to my next question, because at the very opening of the book, time is like, it's a thing. From her counting down to now, Tracy is trying to like help, you know, her father before the time runs out. So we're dealing with that time clock. Then we're dealing with Jamal being on a time clock. You know, as readers read, we'll see like he's like on a race for his life as well. So the pace itself switches back and forth, the actual literal time that they're fighting on the clock, and then the pace of the story, because it speeds up in certain places and then slows down. So how did you manage to keep the pace so that the story flowed and didn't feel rushed or too slowed down? Because when I read it, I was like, oh, we're getting to the good part. So I'm actually now trying to read at a certain speed because I'm like, okay, it's about to go down here. And I'm like, okay, now we relax a little bit. But it never felt like I was off kilter. I felt like this was a natural progression. So how did you do that?
Yeah. Well, I just for the time piece, I'm really symbolic with my writing. I really want there to be lots of meaning. And when I think about what's the most important thing to Tracy, it's that she doesn't have a lot of time. And so that thread is really like built throughout the story. But I thought of it for two different things in terms of pacing is I was really thinking of my Black readers who I think especially are hesitant to pick up any story that deals with things like incarceration or anything, anything around brutality, police brutality, or anything that might sort of signal that there's trauma going to be associated, you know, with it. And so I really wanted to be careful with how I wrote it and not, not have it be so intense that it's just too much to read. I wanted to sort of like slow down the pacing and have these light moments, you know, have love threads and having some investigation threads, but having it be really sort of slowed down, but then picking up the pace again, because I did want to keep up that, like the interest of the reader and I'm a mystery thriller reader and writer. Mm-hmm. And I think that just sort of like pushes you sort of through that you want to be able to, even if the hard moments, but you are feeling like I might be a part of a solution. And so like, I got to keep reading because this actually might, you know, turn into, you know, something good, you know? So I was really, really careful in trying to balance thinking about what my Black readers in particular might be experiencing and what relief they might need at certain moments. And then just in general, trying to keep the pace of a thriller, but I'll also want it to be a contemporary story so that it wasn't just a rush ride, but it also was like a deeper thread with the characters in the story.
And I'm gonna be honest, when I first saw the synopsis of the book, I was like, but I wanted to read it. I was like, I want to read this, but I don't know if I'm ready, because I'm like, I might need a reprieve, not like something to keep me on the coaster, like to go up on a roller coaster. So when I was telling my friends, I'm like, you should really read the book. It's something that you can, and they read it. They read the synopsis. It was like, girl, is this going to be like one of those? I'm like, it is, but it isn't. So I always tell them like, and I noticed this too, despite all the trauma, life is actually happening. So 7 years and Tracy's fighting for her father, but in those 7 years have passed and she's a high school student. Her brother's in high school. Jamal is planning for college. Tracy is planning her senior year. And you can feel the joy moments in there because they're still teenagers. So there's still bouts of joy. So how did you make sure that you had that balance, so it wouldn't just be this one long, sad, you know, good story? Because at first I was just like, well, I don't know, how are we going to do this? But I realized, I'm like, no, it's a flow to this. It's like, they could be going through something crazy and then it's a birthday, or it's like, you know, it's that moment of like romantic element that was in there. And you're like, wow, these are still kids. Like, this is the kidness of it all, because you see that, for the most part, she has to take on a lot of adult responsibility, right? And then you're just like, it's just so heavy for her. And then it's just like, in that same time, it's just like, oh, they're going to do this. And it's like, oh, they're kids again. You know what I mean? Like, you see that they get to be kids. So it's like, even I felt relief. I was like, oh, girl, we got a moment, you know, before it's going to get hectic again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was the hardest thing to do, and probably the hardest thing for me, because, you know, I'm used to, in the work that I do, I'm used to people knowing my intent, who I am, my character. Like, I've always had that respect from people because I've dealt with people. I think that's probably one of the hardest transitions that I've had as a writer. For people who don't know me or know my work, you can see that people automatically are like, ooh, I don't know if I can handle it. I don't know if I'm ready for this kind of thing. And so that for me is probably the hardest thing as a writer, you know, other readers not wanting to like promote the book because they haven't read it yet. So they're just like, oh no, I'm not going to retweet this, you know? So just sort of like from a promotion level, you know, that kind of jacked me up. But once you read it, I think that's a piece where you sort of get to the story. And I think for me, I was really intentional to not have certain kind of traumas on the page. Mm-hmm. So there's things that happen in the past. I might talk about it. I do lean on the emotion, the emotional tension of the absence. So I do that want of having her father back. Trying not to be too graphic or anything like that in the storytelling. Just having those be a lighter than I could, you know, in the story, and then breaking in the joy because. You know, how I really connect to it is that I would hope that if any reader, even if they haven't experienced incarceration or anything like that, if you've experienced racism, there's trauma that's there. There's a piece of edge, there's microaggressions that you experience or just witness because you're watching it on the news and you do feel like it can happen to you. But then, you know, with Black people, we have so much joy in our life. We survive. We actually laugh and joke through some of the hardest moments of our life. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's why it was really important to have all of that, because I think often, you know, white readers or white viewers of media, they want to lean in on the pain. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the more critiques that I had, my Black readers are like, I loved the joy. I loved the human component. I loved all of that. And some white reader critiques are like, oh, that was distracting to have this other relationship piece. Or like, I wanted to know more about this. And I wasn't going to lean, like, I'm writing a story that deals with trauma, but I don't need to lean into that trauma more than the experience, because that's not what I'm trying to do with my story. And so I think for me, it's just like constantly critiquing how I'm writing, what I'm writing, who I'm writing it for. So that helped me, you know, make sure that I kept my sort of eye on the prize of like, no, this is who I'm writing for. And obviously want anyone to read my book, but like really wanted to make sure that I take care of my Black readers.
Well, I love that. Okay. So now I'm going to go into like some of the characters just a little bit. So Dean was an interesting character to me. You know, he's Tracy's friend and they kind of have like this love interest and he's white, right? So that's like the current boy. He's white and he knows Jamal well, the brother, you know, the brother who's on the run, who's believed to have killed a white girl, Angela, right? So, and he admits, you know, for this split second that he allowed himself to like take in that Jamal could be guilty, you know? So I think what makes him like the most interesting out of all of them is that he's supposed to be one of the good guys. You know what I mean? He's an ally. He's showing up where he's supposed to show up. And it's like, but even he succumbs to believing the worst. So did you purposely want to show how easy it was for white people who even with the best of intentions, knowing the history and they, you know, their allies can still get sucked into this, you know, the system kind of like the systematic way of thinking or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think especially during the time period that I was writing, there was like well-intentioned white people who think that maybe they're better than the racism that they were seeing in our country. And, you know, I think you can reflect on, you know, especially thinking about like white women who are, you know, for diversity and, you know, they don't consider themselves racist, but then you look at the Karens that are, you know, doing certain things, you know, that, you know, when push comes to shove, like if they want to weaponize something on race, you know, they will. Or just looking at the percentage of people who actually voted for Trump, even in the face of so much of white supremacy that we were seeing in the country. And I also really am wanting to push the narrative and conversation in a different way is that often it's underrepresented people who are fighting to be anti-racist or to address racism. And I wanted to demonstrate that it's also the responsibility of other non-Black people to do that work. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the people who say are non-Black, who are picking up the book because they're very excited because they do, you know, believe in justice and diversity. I wanted them to see themselves in the book, but I also wanted them to see themselves in Dean and that there's still work to be done. Mm-hmm. And that there's a responsibility for you know, for you to address that. And I live in an environment where I have a lot of majority white people in my community and, you know, who I live in a blue state. I work on a college campus that's very liberal, but there's still entrenched racism that's there. And I sort of want to address it in that way of like, it doesn't make you wrong. It doesn't make you, you know, like but you always have to address it. You always have to, you know, like, yeah, white supremacy runs our country. Mm-hmm. It's in our media, it's everywhere. So you're going to have a piece of it, even if you have a Black friend, right? Or even if you're married to somebody Black, you still have that in you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. So Dean and Quincy, because Quincy, as you read, is also really close to Tracy. And it's also a love interest, obviously. But you begin to see in more depth, like how Dean became close to Tracy and then the relationship between Quincy and Tracy. Like it's two polar opposites, but they have a closeness and they care about her. Did you purposely create that dynamic where you can see more clearly just how heavy race plays into romantic relationships?
Yeah, I wanted to do as much representation as I could of the Black girls like me. Who were growing up who didn't feel like we were represented. We were not a love interest. Mm-hmm. At least where I grew up, I was nobody's love interest. There was no love triangle happening over here. and that sort of like that strong girl thing that, you know, that you're kind of on your own and you do it on your own. So I wanted that. So I wanted Tracy to have options. Mm-hmm. And I also, I love playing, and I did that a lot with a lot of different characters to sort of mirror that at any moment, your life can actually change. And that's really the story of Tracy's life. Mm-hmm. You know, like something very similar to Hurricane Katrina actually upended their life entirely. And then her father being accused of a murder completely changed the trajectory of her life. What happened to Quincy and his father completely changed the trajectory of his life. And Jamal and Quincy actually are, you know, really sort of similar characters of like, it could have as equally happened to Jamal. So Quincy had Quincy was shot at a young age as a sort of a bystander. Mm-hmm. And it sort of ruined his trajectory of running track, but that didn't happen to Jamal. He lost his father. That didn't happen to Jamal. You know, with Dean and Quincy's relationship, that sort of trajectory, Dean was able to step in into their relationship in a way that with Tracy being connected to Quincy, there's so much early trauma connected, that sort of reminder of all the bad things that happened into their life sort of pushed them away in a sense. And I really wanted to sort of play on that, how life choices or life, not even life choices, but things that happen to you actually, actually can impact your life so much. And I felt like that really would touch Black readers, especially to think about how they probably have experienced it and know who people experience who were just on a certain track. And then all of a sudden something completely different happened. And to just break down the, like, it's, you know, like, oh, we're all colorblind and, you know, it's all, as long as you love somebody, you know, it doesn't matter, you know? And it's like, yes. And, you still have to, there's still things that maybe you don't get, you know, like, especially as you get older, some things might change and you might have like more conversations and realize like, oh, wow, we actually don't have a lot in common, you know?
So there's a pivotal moment in the story where Tracy looks at her mother and she says, when I'm ready, I force myself to study mama because I need to learn that strength so I can pass it down like a family recipe, an heirloom, a curse. Have you ever had that moment where you've had to study the Black women in your family or your friends and had to mirror that strength? And was it at an early age?
I think really at an early age when I was aware of a prejudice and being doubted mm-hmm. about my ability, my intellect, mm-hmm. or just even that I was, you know, just dealing with, you know, sort of like racism coming to me. And I think often it's not even only just my family. So I think obviously immediately I think of my mother, I think of my mm-hmm. sisters. I have a lot of women in my life. Black women in my life, but also just historical figures, you know, because I was always an early reader of looking at like I.W. Wells, mm-hmm. Who just had to face through so many tough things. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where we actually find our strength, you know, as Black people, as we look through. Although I always want to break down that it's okay not to be strong. You know, I think it's okay to to not do that. But in that moment, Tracy did have to do that. She did have to learn how to do that. She did have to learn how to survive. There were so many difficulties that happened as a young person where she lives in a really small town. Mm-hmm. And if your father is, you know, thought to be of this, you know, a killer, community, two community members, how would people treat you? You know, she could, her response could be that she could act out in a lot of different ways. Or she does push people out, but she still keeps people in. Yeah. She does keep that sort of tight knit group really close to her. And there's a certain response. And I think with Tracy, she found the, like, how can I be as strong as my mother? Cause her mom had to hold it down too. Even though her mom did struggle as a young person, and that gave Jamal an opportunity to sort of be that father figure, that caring person in the family.
And it was so funny that you mentioned that we as Black women don't have to be strong, because as I was reading, and it was like, that was the part that made me cry. And it was so funny, cause I'm not a crier in books. I'm not the one to go, oh God, she's crying. Was when she realized that she had to fight for Jamal and her father. And it was like, I was just like, no, how is she going to get through this? And then, like, out of nowhere, it was like Innocence X. And I was just like, oh, it was like, she can finally. And she says it. She's like, because she didn't know. She didn't think she would be able to carry, even though she was going to do it. But it's like in her mind, she knows that I can't do this. Like, I really can't do this. I'm going to do it, but I it's no way. But then it was just like, you know, you just, there it goes. And I was just like, we got hope. And it was, even though like that was still like at the beginning and still so much was going to happen, it was just that moment to know that someone cared about this Black girl. Because for 7 years, every week, and it was just like, and she's not fighting for herself, she's fighting for her father. But at the same time, and I'm going on a little bit on a tangent, it's just that I felt like she was fighting for Black people everywhere. It was like every time she wrote that letter, every time she was on it, it was like, it wasn't just our fight, because whatever happens, and that's what I always feel like when I talk to young people, it's like, whatever happens, it's going to benefit you too. And that's why you need to care. For no other reason, it's going to benefit you too. So that was just my two cents. Let me just,
yes.
I'm like, that was the part right there. All everything else, I kept it together, but it was that one part. And I was just like, Lord, how is she going to survive? So it wasn't until, and this was something that I noticed, and it wasn't until the moment that with the fire incident at the home, I won't get into it because I don't want to spoil it, where the Black community began to change the narrative to make it a we problem. So given all that's going on today with Black Lives Matter, the lack of justice that Breonna Taylor got, and so many more injustices that we face as a community, do you think we've collectively created the we outlook on as a community when dealing with these issues outside of just like the hashtag?
I think more so more recently, I don't think it's enough. I definitely think that there has been a longer mobilizing beyond a hashtag. I felt like in 2014, 2015, it was a hashtag. Mm-hmm. There, not to take away from organizing, there's been organizing happening all over the country. There have people who have joined the organizing around it, but it hasn't been something that I think has been as widely embraced across people, that it's more people retweeting something or doing that kind of thing. I definitely think that the prolonged effort, the advocacy, has happened, but I don't think it's been enough. I think that there has to be more engagement. And I'm talking about beyond protesting. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about like actual thinking of legislative work within your community, or supporting national organizations like, you know, the Marshall Project, the Sentencing Project, National Action Network, you know, even the Black Lives Matter as an organization. Mm-hmm. They have many different initiatives, and I think that rallying around that does need to happen. I also do think that we are in a pivotal moment where people who are non-Black are realizing that they need to be paying attention to it too. And I think that's really where it can't just be Black people who are caring about it, but no one else is going to, if no one else is going to do it, who else is going to care more than Black people? So we have to do it. Even if you don't think it'll touch you, it can touch you at any moment. You don't really know. You can live the best life and you never know what could occur, you know? And so that there has to be a lot of work on that. But I think we're finally more alert mm-hmm. and you know awake on these issues.
Yeah, I think so too. But I just want to know your take. So one part in the story that I thought was really interesting was Tracy's best friend, Tasha. She was in a similar situation where her father was going in and out of jail. So he wasn't like, you know, in an extended stay, you know, as the story shows that he goes in and out. And we get to see the different side of that idea of like when my dad or my parent comes home, like, you know, when you watch movies, it's like the gate opens from the prison or the jail, the family runs and it's like they're reunited and everything is just great. And so you took a realistic approach because I know I have friends who had parents come home from prison and it was just how you described it in the book. So what made you make that more realistic versus having it where like, oh, it's a happy, you know, we're a happy family, which is, you can see like Tasha and her father, it's a struggle. She doesn't even call him by like daddy. She calls him another name instead of that because she wants to show how distant that she's placing herself or even like the attitude and all of those changes that she's, you know, getting. So what made you like put that part in it? Because it's almost like the polar opposite with Tracy, who's like, she's trying to get her dad back and one has their dad. And it's like, well, it ain't all peaches and cream either when you get your dad back.
Yeah, I wanted to not just have it be focused on innocent cases mm-hmm. Because I wanted people to pay attention to actually just the criminal justice system mm-hmm. in general. And, you know, there wasn't like a huge, huge representation throughout of Daddy Greg and Tasha throughout the story. But I felt like it was important enough to showcase that, like, there are people who do their time. They go inside for whatever reason. And I think that if I was to tell their story, it could be the story of like, how did it get to that point? Targeting, mm-hmm. harassment, school to prison pipeline, all the different things that sort of add to, situations where someone is sentenced, or even her dad could have been sentenced longer than and someone else white, or it could have been a drug charge where, you know, a white person got off and he actually did do the time, even though he did do something that was illegal. And so I wanted to still have that be part of the story and put a lens to rehabilitation. So that's really is what I wanted to have focus on, is like what actually does, what should occur when someone goes inside. Mm-hmm. You know, should there be rehabilitation? Mm-hmm. I do believe so. If you do a crime and you're out, I think that you should have, you spent your time. You should be like, our goal is like, okay, you spent time because we think that you're sort of paying your mm-hmm. dues for what occurred, but then you are a member of our society. Mm-hmm. How do we bring you back into society? And for Daddy Greg, the struggle that he had was coming back into society. And mm-hmm. this sort of like, when you spent time, you have allegiances of the people who took care of you while you were inside. And he had a struggle with coming out and even trying to find a job, how difficult it is mm-hmm. once you have that mark on your record to actually find work. And so I really wanted to just show that actually it's not easy. It, you know, it can break a family. It can take away from that. And I sort of wanted to have these sort of opposite families of, and so the opposite of Tracy is Tasha, about mm-hmm. the experiences that she had and how her life, you know, was different and how their sort of friendship had some challenges based on the different things that they actually wanted to have in that story.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So Mrs. Evans, deep sigh. In my opinion, she was like the fuel or the engine to this corrupt system. And as you read, you're like, well, I guess maybe she's just scared or she's scary. Maybe it doesn't have to be racism. And then it all comes out, right? And then we get like the story from her angle, or we get the truth. And it's just like, she is the reason why this happens. And as soon as I read her story, I don't know why, but I just went back to like the Trayvon Martin case and the jurors. It was like, after y'all all said, or they came forward, was like, yeah, we kind of didn't agree, but we just went along with it. So once again, Mrs. Evans is like, how do we move forward when it's people that are so, hey, well, the law is the law. And it's like, you know, like, how did you sleep at night? How was it okay for you to just live your life knowing for sure that this wasn't the truth. And this happens all the time. So I guess my question to you is just like, when you see this and when you put that in the book, did you ever think that, okay, people might take it the wrong way or get offensive or just say, well, she just threw that in there because, of course, you know, that had to be the storyline. So what was your process with that? Like Miss Evans as a person, because she was just, whew.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to just break out that our criminal justice system is connected to systemic racism that's connected to just our society. So having a jury of your peers, we have known that that has not always been a fair case in you know, for you know, anyone Black on trial and how difficult it is to have that jury. It's, you know, the police investigation when they're interviewing and how they can be very laser focused, which was something that when I did a lot of my research found is that, you know, when they get so laser focused on it, that you actually can sort of get people to really believe a certain thing, even though they know that they actually witnessed something different or they actually have other kind of information. But they sort of trust the process because the process wasn't built to impact them necessarily. Mm-hmm. It was built to actually impact more Black, brown, and poor people. And so I really wanted to, again, put the lens of focus on the responsibility of white people to work on being anti-racist, to understand how bias works. Because if those assumptions, if a community doesn't put pressure on an investigative situation to close a case, because that's sort of what happened, and it happens so often, is that they want to resolve the case. They've got someone they want to, like, you know, put them on trial and do all of that. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't a community pressure, there would be more time to do investigation. There'd be more time to maybe explore other suspects and gather that kind of evidence. And so, you know, and I think it was also during a time, again, a lot of caring activity was occurring. And I just felt like there's always been so much focus on white men as the white cis hetero men, mm-hmm. As the people that, you know, are the ones that do a lot of wrong and impact the Black community. But I also felt like there hasn't been a lot of focus on white women and their role. You know, regardless of how they were raised and grew up and the traumas that they might have experienced, is that they don't get they don't get to get away with just, you know, it's a good enough excuse. I also was thinking of past as present. I was thinking of Emmett Till, and the woman who accused him and what happened, you know, after, and that sort of legacy in our country. You know, of white women in that role. And I thought it was important to have that current issue, but also be connected to how race is so ingrained and connected in our society, that someone who actually knows so much, mm-hmm. Can still believe that, you know, well, you know, I'm sure he still did it, or I'm sure that, you know, this situation still occurred.
Yes. I see that. And of course, as soon as you said Emmett Till, that like literally rolled into my next question, because the whole like over looming question was the death penalty. Like that was something I kept thinking about. And I had never really thought about the death penalty that in depth. I don't know why, it just never occurred to me to think about it. And the more I thought about it throughout the story, I was just like, well, when you said it, I think you said this earlier, what if we got it wrong? Like you sentenced somebody to death, and what if you got it wrong? That means you said you're dead. And not even just that, when people are wrongfully convicted and they spend like 20 years, because at the end of the day, Tracy's father spent 7 years in jail, like in prison. Like that was just okay. And so do you think people are afraid to care? Because if they did, they will also have to admit that they were complicit.
Yeah. I mean, no one ever wants to think that they actually were a part of taking someone's life away or admit that they're wrong. I've just read so many different cases, and Tracy's father's case is short in terms of appeal. Mm-hmm. If you look at a lot of appeal cases, it's 20, 30, 40 years that people actually then are able to prove their innocence. You know, 7 years is actually a really, really short time period for it to occur. And if you know, having read a lot of cases, what often occurs when I'm looking at the result coming through and the evidence being there is that then prosecutors and judges and states talk about how that, well, the system worked. There's nothing actually wrong with this system, is that there was an appeal. We have an appeal process through our country that you're able to do that. And so our system actually worked. When in reality, no, if it worked, we would have never got it wrong in the first place. If it worked, it wouldn't have taken so much to actually get an appeal, because it is so much effort for an appeal. And, you know, it just is the disproportion. I actually never really thought much about the death penalty before, until Helene Thomas is someone who's done some advocacy work that I, you know, early years, I paid attention to it, but it really was watching more Bryan Stevenson and the work that he was doing right before Just Mercy came out. My husband and his twin brother are really into criminal justice and that kind of work. And so I've read lots of books like right around that sort of time period that his book came out. And that's where I started to pay attention and see the deep connection and the disparity, and looking at data like 95% of prosecutors are white. If you look at certain states like Louisiana and Mississippi, when it's cases of someone who was black that was murdered versus someone who was white that was murdered, based on the race of that person, black people were three times more likely to actually be prosecuted and sentenced to the death sentence versus white on white crime. And so there's all kinds of data that actually show that, in general, the death sentence really does impact Black people. And Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow is a book that I read right upon its release, actually right before I read Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy. And that's where I made the connection of, you know, that it's, you know, our criminal justice system and the death sentence is just like lynching. It's a new version of lynching. But except for this time, rather than them making a decision without going to a trial, is that they actually now, you know, they go through a trial in a process and a system that you can only win if you have the capital. Bryan Stevenson talks about this all the time. If you have the capital, you're able to defend yourself. But if you don't have the capital, then you're disproportionately impacted. And adding black and brown communities on top of that has an even increased impact on that.
Yeah. And it's scary, because it's just like, I guess that's why this to me is such an important book for, I think, young Black kids, or to me before they even hit college, if they get in elementary school, is the idea that your life can change so quickly. And it's not even that it has to be your fault. It's all these outside forces that are working, and you're like sitting in the cell, you just don't know why. You know what I mean? You just don't even know what's going on from one moment to the next, and you're just being shuffled. You know, you shuffled here and you shuffled there. And just to know that it's not just you, or it's, you know, that idea that if you can read this and at least be educated and have that information to just know. Because one thing that Tracy did do, she taught like these, you know, classes on what to do when you encounter the police, because she knew, you know, it would be that quick. So she even tried to give, you know, she was giving back in her own way as well. Even though she was fighting for her dad, she was still doing workshops to help, you know, young kids, young people know, like, if this happens to you, like, you're no longer looked at as like a baby no more. Like, after that certain, like, 11, 12, it's like, you might have a baby face, but you're not, they're not looking at you like that. And so for young kids, I think this book is super important. But this is like the last question. I have one more after that. But when I read If Beale Street Could Talk by James Baldwin, I loved the story. Like, I was just like so engulfed with it. But then I got to the end and I had like this blank stare. I was just like, what? And it sat with me for a long time, because I was just like, because you're looking for that, almost like the happily ever after, like, no, we win in the end. And so in your story, we get to breathe a bit, and we have, and our hearts become lighter. Like the struggle isn't over, the fighting isn't over, but it was one of those moments where you're like, whew, you know, I could take a moment and I could just bask in this happiness. So when writing your ending, did you want to give readers that hope by ending it the way that you did?
Yeah, part of that is why young adult work, you typically do want to have some kind of happy ending. But I think it was just trying to balance out not having so much trauma. Mm-hmm. Like, it was important to me that it provides a call to action of like, if you do all of this effort, like you can make a difference. And so I wanted to do that. And I read, I think, almost everything of James Baldwin. But If Beale Street Could Talk actually is one that I didn't read until after my book is out. And I didn't even watch the movie. So it was actually one of those that I never got to. And I never knew what it was about. I think I was more reading his essays and like The Fire Next Time and Go Meet a Man on the Mountain, whatever that book is called. And so after that, I was at the very end and I was like, man, this is depressing. What happened?
That's what I'm saying. But you just end up like, what?
Good though. Yeah, it's good.
It's really great. But like, you get to the end, you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah. You know, and I actually read it on audiobook because Bonnie Turpin is the narrator for my audiobook. And so she did that for If Beale Street Could Talk. And then I was like, I was going back on the audiobook, like, did we miss a chapter? Is it over? So yeah, I just don't, I think especially for writing young adult and the kind of stuff that I, covered, it was important that there was some hope that was there and left there,
Okay. Hey, I'm happy because I was just like, if she does it, if Bill does it, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to just have to walk away. Because I was bracing myself the whole time. I'm like, this could go left or go right. Help us all. So I happen to work at the illustrious Schomburg Center. I am a media instructor for the Junior Scholars Program. It's a program for Black kids from 11 to 18, where they get to, for the first half of the year, we do Black studies. And for the second half of the year, they do a special project, which is theater, visual arts, media. We had Black comics, we had dance, we had all of that. And so the thing is, we have these heavy conversations. Like, I'm trying to get this book, because every year they have a book. So last year was Autobiography of Malcolm X. The year before was Homegoing. So every year they have a book, and I am pushing. When I say I'm pushing to make this the book, this to be the book. But one of the things that we always talk about, because we have like these heavy topics, is that they sometimes feel hopeless. Because you see, just like we're watching the news, they're watching the news, just like they're seeing the outcomes and they're seeing the protests and they're seeing like how the cops are interacting with people, they're seeing that and they're internalizing it and they're young. This is them. I remember some of my scholars saying like the first time that they realized that they could die at any moment was when Trayvon Martin. And I'm just like, how are you walking with that? You know what I mean? That's heavy to walk with that. And, I'm based in New York City and, Schomburg is in Harlem. And so it's just like, you see the environment and you see like how it can really just go left at any moment. This can be one of the kids that I teach. This can be one of their friends. So in the story, Jamal is in the shed, right? And he has all these books. He has books by W.E.B. Du Bois. He has books by, I believe, Baldwin and Thurgood Marshall. And he makes this statement where he's just like, they all say the same thing over and over again. And doesn't matter. The laws might change. Other things might change. But it's just like, there's nothing that's going to happen because it's all been said. Everything that you can think of, every philosopher, every Black teacher, they've all said it and nothing is changing. And he's just like, they just hate us so damn much. And when he said that, I was just like, wow, it was just like one of those things where it's just like, I understood exactly where he was coming from. And he has that at such a young age. And I'm like, I know kids that really feel hopeless or when they interact with the cops, if they're just sitting down, hanging out, being loud and rowdy, obviously, but they're 16, they're supposed to be loud and rowdy. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You can see it. And it's just like, our program teaches them how to advocate for themselves. But for kids who are just out there in the world, Black kids, what advice or words of encouragement can you offer them if they do feel like Jamal?
And I think it's true and it's authentic and it's okay to feel like that at some points in your life. But then they win if you feel that way ongoing and you give up. And I really believe, I believe in activism. I believe in organizing. I believe in using your voice. I think that we are a people that have proved that work can be done even through the hardest times. And so I think for young people, it's just about how do you want to use your voice? Who do you want to be? And how can you make that happen? It was a dark moment for Jamal, but he had someone to go to express that to, who could get him out of that dark moment so that he didn't give up, you know, and help him. And I think that's about like finding community and finding people who can feed into to supporting you so that when you're in that dark moment that you actually can believe that, but let's look at actually all of the amazing things that are possible and can be possible that we've been able to see. And so that's sort of the biggest thing is that how do you give young people opportunities to learn about heroic people, not even like heroic in like this, you know, but just like, you know, stories about someone who had, you know, a similar situation that maybe they experienced a hard life growing up, or they didn't have access to housing security or food security wasn't easy for them, or they were, you know, targeted, but how can they actually like go on and do great things? And I think that's the important thing is for them to find out what their passion is, what they're interested in. And it doesn't have to be activism. It could just be like being really great at something that they want to do and that they believe could be a part of like maybe, you know, their future in some way.
Thank you. I think that was like the perfect answer because, you know, you can win. Like you can win. You will win. So these are like flash questions. So these are really, really quick. And then that's it. So writing in the day or writing at night?
In the day.
Reading reading a standalone or a series?
Standalone.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Apple or Droid?
Apple or what?
iPhone or Droid?
Oh, Apple.
Martin Luther King or Malcolm X?
Ooh, Malcolm.
living single or girlfriends?
Oh, living single.
And who is Kim Johnson?
Oh. I'm a mother. I'm a writer. I'm an activist. I don't know what else to say. That's who I am.
That's all there has to be. Thank you so much. This was like
I love it. That was fun.
So girls, that concludes the interview, and I hope that you enjoyed it. Be sure to follow us on the internet. On Instagram, it's at Sister Girls Book Club. My personal Instagram is the Sister Girl Next Door. On Twitter, it's Sister Girls BC for the book club. And my personal Twitter is Sheree Writes. And of course, the SisterGirlNextDoor.com for the site. And make sure you share and comment. If you like the vibe, comment and subscribe. Okay? Later.